This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Well, as vaccines get into the arms of millions across California, LA County is poised to move into the red tier for the first time since the state started using a tier system to limit what's open. What does that mean? Well, movie theaters and gyms will be able to open up, or at least reopen, with limited capacity. And restaurants will allow indoor dining here in LA for the first time since last summer. Now, the food service industry has long suffered during this pandemic, you know that. And now your favorite place could get the green light to open indoors at 25% capacity sometime in the next week. How are restaurant owners and their workers feeling about all this? Great news for them, right? More business. Well, yeah, but they also have some fears, from changing course to customer behavior. KCRW's own Angel Carrera has talked to people in the industry to see how they're feeling, and he's with us right now. Hey, Angel.
Hey, Steve.
So this is good news about reopening indoor dining, right? Even at 25%.
Well, that's not how everyone sees it. So this is A. She works at a couple of places, a popular French spot in Silver Lake, and a very Instagrammable rooftop restaurant. And by the way, I'm only using one of her initials. She's fearful of retaliation, doesn't want to get fired. But she's been working in outdoor dining spaces since they reopened in January.
I think that it's going to be a nightmare when indoor dining reopens. I think it's way too soon. And if outdoor dining is any indication of how people are behaving and completely disregarding the rules, then I'm just absolutely horrified to think about what's going to happen when we add more on top of that and open up indoor as well.
And she also tells me customers have basically been blaming staff for things not feeling normal during a pandemic.
People will still get outraged about things that are beyond their control, like, you know, it's too cold and, you know, the heat lamp isn't hot enough. Well, it's like, you know, we can't control the weather. You see how freezing it is. You're choosing to dine out on a night that's 55 degrees, and now you're upset with us because it's cold. So I don't know if it's just people's entitlement or if it's just the frustration of the past year, but I feel like overall, it's kind of brought out the worst in people, and they seem to be taking it out on servers. And a lot of times the easiest way to do that is by tipping less or not tipping at all. And usually it's, like I said, it's for things that are completely beyond our control and don't even really have anything to do with the service that we are providing them.
So there's that. And she mentions more bad behavior in general, like customers skirting party size rules. For example, you can have six people at a table, more people will join them under the guise of a different party, and it's just hard to manage for servers for safety reasons. And with the return of indoor dining, guess where people want to sit during a breezy spring? Indoors.
If we do it at 25 capacity, I can already see everyone's going to request it. Not everyone will be able to get it. So then now we've got more people upset. You know, well, I wanted to be inside. So I'm not looking forward to that.
You know, I worked in the food service industry for a long time, grew up in it, being a Greek American, and I can tell you it's really difficult, Angel, to please everybody, especially when you're serving them food. And I know, you know, there are people, not everyone's doing these things, right? Not everyone has these behavior issues.
Yeah, it's not all awful out there. So Eric Jayati, he's a managing partner and sometimes server of Bone Kettle in Pasadena. And he told me, for instance, people now relish the experience of dining out. His restaurant delivers too, and he tells me restaurants will invite him in for a glass of wine, that it feels more personable.
Well, that's nice to hear. For business owners, Angel, it must be more straightforward, though. Like, opening up means more tables, means more business. That's good for them, right?
Well, yes, but they can't get too excited till they know it's for real and long-term this time. They've been through this before.
The analogy I use is when Lucy's holding the football and Charlie Brown goes to kick it and she pulls it out of the way and he falls on his ass. That's been this last year.
So that is Kevin Norton, owner of Supply and Demand, a relatively new bar / restaurant / music venue in Long Beach. In this last year, his business has been like a lot of places around town. Closed, then reopened, closed again, reinvented for outdoor dining, and in his case, adding live stream music performances for income as well. Norton calls himself stubborn and refused to close, says he can roll with the business punches. But when I asked him how much money he'd lost last year, he said, and I quote, "Just dig a hole in your backyard, fill it with money, and light it on fire." And that gives you an idea. He says the most frustrating thing about this, though, has been communications with state and county officials.
All you hear is rumors. Like, every time we've reopened or reclosed, I heard about, because there was a rumor. We have a network of bar owners and restaurant owners and our employees, and everybody kind of heard, hey, we're going to be opening soon. And it's been pretty accurate so far, but it'd be really nice if we got, like, a note from the city or the state or county, you know, that this would happen, other than, like, okay, you can open in 2 days, you know, which, especially after, you know, all the being closed for so much, you know, where, and then how it's missed, you know, the big box stores, the Walmarts of the world, they haven't been closed a day, you know, and they have hundreds of people every day. So it's just kind of frustrating.
I would hope, Angel, that communication gets better. I mean, we're on, hopefully, knock wood, you know, on the downslope of this thing. And maybe more and more things can open, and people like Kevin Norton won't have to worry about the open-close, reopen, reclose shuffle, right?
Yeah, it's been frustrating for him. And here's a little example of what he went through last summer.
For example, the June reopening, we literally reordered thousands of dollars worth of, you know, alcohol and kegs and food and whatnot. And when we reopened, we got closed down a week later. So we used to run 12 draft beers. Right now we're doing 4 because we just, you know, now we're feeling more and more comfortable that it's going to stay open. But, you know, there's, after they shut you down that many times, there's an apprehension to spend money on perishables.
He says, though he may sound grumpy or, quote, like one of those Texas places, he assures me he's not an open everything now guy, that he sees light at the end of the tunnel.
We are optimistic about the future, and we're happy that, you know, that it seems like Biden's really doing his job, you know, getting the vaccines out there and doing all that stuff. So and then the mayor's trying to get it going in Long Beach with the vaccine. So we think it's going to turn around, and you know, that's all we can do, right? We got to hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
Oh, boy. Fingers crossed we are done with the worst. Right, Steve?
Well, we hope. There is always that danger, though, that people get a little too complacent. And with this thing, you never know. There are a lot of ebbs and flows. KCRW's Angel Carreras reporting for us. Angel, thanks.
Steve, thank you so much.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Schools at LA Unified have been mostly dark for a full year now. No teachers shepherding kids to class, no high school musicals in the auditorium, no LAUSD coffee cake. But there is a bright fluorescent light at the end of this remote school tunnel. The district and its teachers union reached a tentative agreement to reopen some classrooms as soon as next month, with a goal of offering in-person options to all students by May. The plan is supposed to allow enough time for teachers and staff to get fully vaccinated, but school is expected to look a whole lot different when the kids meet up again inside. And what about those families who are worried about in-person learning? Well, a couple of teachers who have become regulars here on Greater LA are here now to share their thoughts about it. They've been online with their students since the shutdown. I can't even believe I'm saying this, since March of 2020. This was a year ago. Aviva Alvarez-Axon, Miss Z, she teaches world history and ethnic studies over at Hamilton High School off of Robertson. Aviva, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Christy Collette teaches third graders at Newcastle Elementary in the Valley in Reseda. Christy, welcome to you as well.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
First, I want to start with you, Christy, because your reaction to this agreement, obviously, elementary school and high need students would return first. That puts you in the mix soonest. You could be back in the classroom with your kids in gosh, a little more than a month, right? How do you feel about that?
I'm actually very excited to be able to go back to school and see the kids in person. I do have some apprehensions. Of course, it's a little scary, but something definitely to look forward to. As you said, sort of a light at the end of the tunnel, finally.
Aviva, last time we talked to you, this was during the holidays. You said that even when in-person learning resumes, that school is not really going to look like school. What did you mean by that? And what are the differences we're talking about?
Sure. So even the current tentative agreement that UTLA reached with the district for high school, the current proposal is that students would be cohorted with their advisory classes, which is kind of our emotional support class that we have for all of our students. So they have kind of a home base to go to with a teacher. But most teachers don't necessarily teach their advisory students an actual academic class. Those would still be taught essentially distance learning style. So the teacher would be in a classroom with their advisory students while their advisory students take their own schedule of classes, which are likely to be different from their neighbors, while the teacher is teaching their own set of classes essentially remotely while their students are either at home, if they chose that option, or if they're at school from whatever classroom that they're in with their own advisory teacher.
Gotcha. So online learning, though, from one classroom, and I wonder, how different is that than what we're doing right now?
That's what I wonder, too. I think the big differences that come into play are for, you know, some students, you know, they need a place to go. Thoroughly understanding that we have students who are homeless. We have students whose home situation just really hasn't been conducive to learning this entire time. And perhaps being on campus might be helpful. I have my thoughts on that, because what's the difference between having your, you know, 6-year-old sibling do kindergarten right next to you than having your classmate do geometry while you're doing history right next to you? I'm not really sure. But with that, when it comes down to like this idea that it would be emotionally beneficial, I don't know how much that holds water, because if you're not like they're not socializing necessarily with their peers. They're in school and then they're not allowed to be near each other. I still don't really know how things like lunch and passing periods will work. It just doesn't seem that much different, but I'm open to seeing what the plans really are in detail.
Christy, how about you? I mean, talk about, your kids are a little younger. You talked about students not being able to use the library or play with gym equipment or share supplies, something that Aviva alluded to as well, not being able to really socialize with one another. What will they be able to do?
That's a really good question. I think right now the problem is we don't really have a good idea of what that's going to look like. And for elementary kids, the proposal is having like an AM, PM schedule. So even when the schools are open, the kids are probably going to be there maybe about half time. So maybe 2 days a week or 4 half days a week. And my biggest concern with that is how much more instructional time is going to get cut because of that, if they're now only receiving half of a day instead of the full day of instruction.
Right. Where you can do a full day of instruction if you're online from home, right?
Correct. And I have had, it is parent conference week this week, and I've had a large number of my families say that they did not intend to send their kids back to in-person teaching yet.
That leads to something else that I saw that's so curious. Did you guys see this poll that came out earlier this month? This is by NPR and Ipsos. They surveyed parents all across the country in English and in Spanish. Nearly a third, this is 29%, said that they were likely to stick with remote learning indefinitely. That seems like a high number to me. I mean, does it surprise you, Christy?
It actually does not. I have had many students who are doing significantly better this year than they were doing last year. And I also know from personal friends a lot of students who have special needs who maybe weren't as successful in the classroom are able to find that success on their own time online now.
What about you, Aviva? Does that reflect what you're hearing from parents at your school?
Generally, yes. I'm mostly talk to students, but there's a lot of anxiety around returning to school, especially considering that our Black and Brown communities were hit disproportionately so hard by this virus. And our students are still experiencing huge losses because of COVID when it comes to, you know, family and friend deaths, unfortunately. It's scary out there. And so this idea of like, you know, the best way to protect your child is knowing where they are and what they're doing, and then just knowing that they're with you and safe and knowing that they're with their family. It does make sense to me that a lot of families would want to keep that closeness or just kind of keep that sense of security.
Are you going to have to juggle that? I mean, is there going to be the option to opt out, not have your kid in school, and then you do online learning, and then here you are teaching in class and online? That sounds like a lot for you.
No, that sounds like it's not. That's a big part of the agreement, is that we will not be required to teach online and in person simultaneously. Again, how that works, if a lot of families continue to stay on online learning, I don't really know, but that was part of our agreement.
What kind of families do you think are we talking about? I mean, is this a socioeconomic thing?
I think the most vocal parents that I'm hearing from are parents who are primarily upper class white families that seem to really be pushing for the return to school.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's affluent families who have not been harmed by this virus disproportionately, who have not, you know, faced that like actual daily fear of, you know, having met multiple loved ones in the hospital. They are, you know, more chomping at the bit to return because it's less of an anxiety inducing situation. And there, we also can think about who has had access to the vaccine up to this point. If you work in the medical field, if you work in education, you've had access. Those are both occupations that have degrees associated with them. And then on top of that, the people who have been able to access the vaccine through more back channel or have the ability to take a day off and wait for a spare vaccine, right? Those are going to be disproportionately affluent families.
I want to thank you both so much for your time. Christy Kolech teaches third grade over in Reseda. Aviva Alvarez Zaxson, Ms. Z, who's over at Hamilton High School. Thanks to you both, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, by the way, just today, the LA Unified School Board has unanimously approved an agreement with UTLA, the teachers union, for a return to in-person instruction next month. The teachers union, by the way, still has to ratify that, and that is expected. But again, LAUSD on board with that, with instruction, in-person instruction for younger students starting next month. Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. More than 22,000 Angelenos have died from COVID-19. The destruction from the pandemic is enormous. It is deeply personal, too. So this week on Greater LA, we've been taking you beyond the statistics to bring you a short story about one individual Southern Californian lost to this terrible pandemic, as remembered by those who loved them. Today, the story of a beloved father, a loyal friend. Eric Madrid worked at Johnny's Bar. That's a dive bar in Highland Park. He worked security, doorman. He did a bit of everything there. He was well known and he was well loved. After his death at the age of 50, the young age of 50, back in January, a GoFundMe to support his 17-year-old daughter's college fund was shared widely and went over its goal in just a few days. KCRW's Angel Carreras recently sat down with Eric Madrid's family. Here is Eric's story, as told by his brother Mark, his sister-in-law Amber, his dad, Tony, his friend and co-worker, Candy Cordova, and his daughter, Victoria.
If he wasn't the life of the party at that moment, give him 10 minutes and he would have a circle in front of him. Me and Eric were 3 years apart. We grew up in Highland Park. Majority of our lives, we attended St. Ignatius Grammar School. Growing up in the 80s, you know, the whole pop locking was invented back then. And everybody was doing it. And, you know, he would always come to me and say, Mark, you know, let's do this dance routine. You know, and we would practice in the front room. And you know, he had some good moves. Take a look at what I've done. Used to rock in my basement, now I'm number one. He was quite known for doing birthdays in Johnny's by yelling, "May I have your attention?
May I have your attention, please?" And pour a shot and made everybody sing. you know, happy birthday to whomever was, whose birthday it was. And that was his thing. No one ever told him to do it. And the customers loved it.
There was a bit of pleasure in humiliation, right? It wasn't over the top. It wasn't mean. It wasn't where somebody could get crossed up on their feelings. It was absolutely good nature. And if he could embarrass you at the same time as laugh with you, it was a mission success.
I first read it in his yearbook and I was like, what is this? And he was just like, oh yeah, it's a nickname.
Okay, so Eric's nickname was Radar because as soon as he would walk into a group of people at a party, his head would be on a swivel, like a radar would be going off. And within five or 10 minutes, he would be talking to a girl. And, you know, my brother was a good-looking guy. He had a nice smile. He had a good haircut. And throughout his entire life, he did have a lot of friends that were girls.
He had the gift of gab, and he knew how to make the ladies laugh, and they were like putty in his hands. It was funny. He knew what to say.
What I loved the most about him would be probably the time, you know, as a family, we found out that he was going to have a baby.
I grew up where if a girl was to say, I'm pregnant, or this kid is yours, the men would say, no, that's not mine. That's not mine. And Eric found out that there was this little girl that was his daughter. He was bound and determined. He was going to get her. And he brought his daughter home.
You know, he became absolutely saturated with love. And that love kind of transponded into him being even more goofier sometimes. You know, seeing him on his hands and knees with his daughter, you know, rolling around, and he's a big guy, right? You know, he's 6'1", you know, he's 300 pounds. And so he's a big guy, and to see his daughter make him melt like that, it was absolutely precious.
He spoiled me with his time. He would take me everywhere. I'd go on adventures with him. That's what I'd call it. He'd bring things home for me. It could be something he found that he thought was cool. It was like a new toy, something I could play with my dad. He would be like a horse sometimes. And this, yeah, like he'd go on like all fours, like on the carpet and like walk around. And I'd be like, yeah. And he'd go. And like, I look at it now and I'm like, that's ridiculous. But it was fun. Like, I didn't have to go to Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm. I could go to the park with him, and it was fine. He went to the Selena Gomez concert with me, though. The Selena Gomez concert was like the first concert I had ever gone to. He held this sign that I made that said, I heart Sel, because I couldn't spell Selena Gomez because it was too small. It had lights and everything. So there's this man just carrying around this neon sign. I think just like seeing me happy was good for him. He liked seeing me happy.
He allowed everybody to gravitate towards him. He asked everybody how they were doing, and he was generally interested in their day, what happened to them. He'd always, if something was wrong, it's okay, it'll be better. Don't worry about it. Go and have a drink. Have a good time.
He truly was himself, unapologetically. You know, sometimes there were times where you're like, what is your brother doing? But that was who he was. He was doing something crazy, and it was funny and entertaining, and he was a riot to be around.
His last words he ever spoke was his unconditional love for his daughter, making sure that Vicky is taken care of. Is a testament to his one-track mind when it came to his daughter, you know, and he will be missed. He will be missed.
Like, there's this amazing photo of him just with, like, the biggest smile, and I'm like, yeah, that's my dad. Like, you rarely saw him mad or sad, mainly because he wanted to be happy for other people. It's kind of like what he lived for. He was like a ball of sun. He could walk into any room and everyone would be laughing. You could be having the worst day and you see him smile and everything's better. He had that big of an impact on people.
A tribute to Eric Madrid of Highland Park. He died from COVID complications in January. He was remembered by Mark and Amber, Tony and Victoria Madrid, and Candy Cordova. Thanks to KCRW's Angel Carreras, who produced that tribute for us. Thank you for being with us today. Next week, demand and supply of a life-saving shot in one small part of Greater LA, and how one of LA's main drags has been affected by a year of pandemic. If you've gotten your full vaccine, share your story with us. Do you feel safer? What are you doing now that you haven't been able to do? Tell us at kcrw.com/greaterla. On this one-year anniversary of the coronavirus being deemed a pandemic, President Biden will address the nation this evening. KCRW will have that live for you starting at 5. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Amy Toff, Phil Richards, Jody Adler, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show today. Thank you for your ears and your time. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.